Chapter 6. Toad, that is to say, awakened him to a sense of his situation. I addressed myself to the task forthwith. Once more I betook myself to remonstrance. Again I collected my energies for a final attempt at expostulation. When I had made an end of my lecture, Mr. Dammit indulged himself in some very equivocal behavior. For some moments he remained silent, merely looking me inquisitively in the face. But presently he threw his head to one side, and elevated his eyebrows to a great extent. Then he spread out the palms of his hands and shrugged up his shoulders. Then he winked with the right eye. Then he repeated the operation with the left. Then he shut them both up very tight. Then he opened them both so very wide, that I became seriously alarmed for the consequences. Then, applying his thumb to his nose, he thought proper to make an indescribable movement with the rest of his fingers. Finally, setting his arms akimbo, he condescended to reply. I can call to mind only the beats of his discourse. He would be obliged to me if I would hold my tongue. He wished none of my advice. He despised all my insinuations. He was old enough to take care of himself. Did I still think him baby Dammit? Did I mean to say anything against his character? Did I intend to insult him? Was I a fool? Was my maternal parent aware, in a word, of my absence from the domiciliary residence? He would put this latter question to me, as to a man of veracity, and he would bind himself to abide by my reply. Once more he would demand explicitly, if my mother knew, that I was out. My confusion, he said, betrayed me, and he would be willing to bet the devil his head, that she did not. Mr. Dammit did not pause for my rejoinder. Turning upon his heel, he left my presence with undignified precipitation. It was well for him that he did so. My feelings had been wounded. Even my anger had been aroused. For once I would have taken him up upon his insulting wager. I would have won for the archenemy Mr. Dammit's little head, for the fact is, my mama was very well aware of my merely temporary absence from home. But coat a sheaf amid head heaven gives relief, as the Muslimmen say when you tread upon their toes. It was in pursuance of my duty that I had been insulted, and I bore the insult like a man. It now seemed to me, however, that I had done all that could be required of me in the case of this miserable individual, and I resolved to trouble him no longer with my counsel, but to leave him to his conscience and himself. But although I forbore to intrude with my advice, I could not bring myself to give up his society altogether. I even went so far as to humor some of his less reprehensible propensities, and there were times when I found myself lauding his wicked jokes, as epicures do mustard, with tears in my eyes. So profoundly did it grieve me to hear his evil talk. One fine day, having strolled out together, arm in arm, our route led us in the direction of a river. There was a bridge, and we resolved to cross it. It was roofed over, by way of protection from the weather, and the archway, having but few windows, was thus very uncomfortably dark. As we entered the passage, the contrast between the external glare and the interior gloom struck heavily upon my spirits. Not so upon those of the unhappy Dammit, who offered to bet the devil his head that I was hipped. He seemed to be in an unusual good humor. He was excessively lively, so much so that I entertained I know not what of uneasy suspicion. It is not impossible that he was affected with the transcendentals. I am not well enough versed, however, in the diagnosis of this disease to speak with decision upon the point, and unhappily there were none of my friends of the isle present. I suggest the idea, nevertheless, because of a certain species of austere Mary Andrewism which seemed to beset my poor friend, and caused him to make quite a tomfool of himself. Nothing would serve him but wriggling and skipping about under and over everything that came in his way, now shouting out, and now lisping out, all manner of odd little and big words, yet preserving the gravest face in the world all the time. I really could not make up my mind whether to kick or to pity him. At length, Having passed nearly across the bridge, we approached the termination of the footway, when our progress was impeded by a turnstile of some height. Through this I made my way quietly, pushing it around as usual. But this turn would not serve the turn of Mr. Dammit. He insisted upon leaping the stile, and said he could cut a pigeon wing over it in the air. Now this, conscientiously speaking, I did not think he could do. The best pigeon winger over all kinds of style was my friend Mr. Carlyle, and as I knew he could not do it, I would not believe that it could be done by Toby Dammit. I therefore told him, in so many words, that he was a braggadocio, and could not do what he said. For this I had reason to be sorry afterward, for he straightway offered to bet the devil his head that he could. I was about to reply, notwithstanding my previous resolutions, with some remonstrance against his impiety, when I heard, close at my elbow, a slight cough, which sounded very much like the ejaculation, "Hem!" I started, and looked about me in surprise. My glance at length fell into a nook of the framework of the bridge, and upon the figure of a little lame old gentleman of venerable aspect. Nothing could be more reverend than his whole appearance, for he not only had on a full suit of black, but his shirt was perfectly clean, and the collar turned very neatly down over a white cravat, while his hair was parted in front like a girl's. His hands were clasped pensively together over his stomach, and his two eyes were carefully rolled up into the top of his head. Upon observing him more closely, I perceived that he wore a black silk apron over his small clothes, and this was a thing which I thought very odd. Before I had time to make any remark, however, upon so singular a circumstance, he interrupted me with a second "hem." To this observation I was not immediately prepared to reply. The fact is, remarks of this laconic nature are nearly unanswerable. I have known a Quarterly Review nonplussed by the word "uch." I am not ashamed to say, therefore, that I turned to Mr. Dammit for assistance. "Dammit," said I, "what are you about? Don't you hear? The gentleman says ahem." Apostrophe I looked sternly at my friend, while I thus addressed him. For, to say the truth, I felt particularly puzzled, and when a man is particularly puzzled he must knit his brows and look savage, or else he is pretty sure to look like a fool. "Dammit," observed I, although this sounded very much like an oath, than which nothing was further from my thoughts, "ammit," I suggested the gentleman says ahem. Apostrophe, I do not attempt to defend my remark on the score of profundity. I did not think it profound myself, but I have noticed that the effect of our speeches is not always proportionate with their importance in our own eyes, and if I had shot Mr. D through and through with a Paxson bomb, or knocked him in the head with the Etz and Poetry of America, he could hardly have been more discomfited than when I addressed him with those simple words, "colon dammit, what are you about? Don't you hear? The gentleman says ahem." "Apostrophe, you don't say so?" gasped he at length, after turning more colors than a pirate runs up, one after the other, when chased by a man of war. "Are you quite sure he said that? Well, at all events I am in for it now, and may as well put a bold face upon the matter. Here goes, then, ahem." At this the little old gentleman seemed pleased, God only knows why. He left his station at the nook of the bridge, limped forward with a gracious air, took Dammit by the hand, and shook it cordially, looking all the while straight up in his face with an air of the most unadulterated benignity which it is possible for the mind of man to imagine. "I am quite sure you will win it, Dammit," said he, with the frankest of all smiles, "but we are obliged to have a trial, you know, for the sake of mere form." "Ahem," replied my friend, taking off his coat, with a deep sigh, tying a pocket handkerchief around his waist, and producing an unaccountable alteration in his countenance, by twisting up his eyes and bringing down the corners of his mouth, "hem," and "hem," said he again, after a pause, and not another word more than "hem" did I ever know him to say after that. Aha! thought I, without expressing myself aloud, it is quite a remarkable silence on the part of Toby Dammit, and is no doubt a consequence of his verbosity upon a previous occasion. One extreme induces another. I wonder if he has forgotten the many unanswerable questions which he propounded to me so fluently on the day when I gave him my last lecture. At all events, he is cured of the transcendentals. Ahem. He replied Toby, just as if he had been reading my thoughts, and looking like a very old sheep in a reverie. The old gentleman now took him by the arm, and led him more into the shade of the bridge a few paces back from the turnstile. My good fellow, said he, I make it a point of conscience to allow you this much run. Wait here, till I take my place by the stile, so that I may see whether you go over it handsomely and transcendentally, and don't omit any flourishes of the pigeon wing. A mere form, you know. I will say one, two, three, and away. Apostrophe, apostrophe, mind you, start at the word away. Here he took his position by the stile, paused a moment, as if in profound reflection, then looked up, and, I thought, smiled very slightly, then tightened the strings of his apron, then took a long look at Dammit, and finally gave the word as agreed upon, one, two, three, and away. Punctually at the word way, my poor friend set off in a strong gallop. The stile was not very high, like Mr. Lord's, nor yet very low, like that of Mr. Lord's reviewers, but upon the whole I made sure that he would clear it. And then what, if he did not? Ah, that was the question, what, if he did not? W what right, said I, had the old gentleman, to make any other gentleman jump? The little old dot and carry one. Who is he? If he asks me to jump, I won't do it, that's flat, and I don't care who the devil he is. The bridge, as I say, was arched and covered in a very ridiculous manner, and there was a most uncomfortable echo about it at all times, an echo which I never before so particularly observed as when I uttered the four last words of my remark. But what I said, or what I thought, or what I heard, occupied only an instant. In less than 5 seconds from his starting, my poor Toby had taken the leap. I saw him run nimbly, and spring grandly from the floor of the bridge, cutting the most awful flourishes with his legs as he went up. I saw him high in the air, pigeon-winging it to admiration just over the top of the stile. And of course I thought it an unusually singular thing that he did not continue to go over. But the whole leap was the affair of a moment, and, before I had a chance to make any profound reflections, down came Mr. Dammit on the flat of his back, on the same side of the stile from which he had started. At the same instant I saw the old gentleman limping off at the top of his speed, having caught and wrapped up in his apron something that fell heavily into it from the darkness of the arch just over the turnstile. At all this, I was much astonished. But I had no leisure to think, for Dammit lay particularly still, and I concluded that his feelings had been hurt, and that he stood in need of my assistance. I hurried up to him, and found that he had received what might be termed a serious injury. The truth is, he had been deprived of his head, which after a close search I could not find anywhere, so I determined to take him home, and send for the homeopathists. In the meantime a thought struck me, and I threw open an adjacent window of the bridge, when the sad truth flashed upon me at once. About 5 feet just above the top of the turnstile, and crossing the arch of the footpath so as to constitute a brace, there extended a flat iron bar, lying with its breadth horizontally, and forming one of a series that served to strengthen the structure throughout its extent. With the edge of this brace it appeared evident that the neck of my unfortunate friend had come precisely in contact. He did not long survive his terrible loss. The homeopathists did not give him little enough physic, and what little they did give him, he hesitated to take. So in the end he grew worse, and at length died, a lesson to all riotous livers. I bedewed his grave with my tears, worked a bar sinister on his family escutcheon, and, for the general expenses of his funeral, sent in my very moderate bill to the Transcendentalists. The scoundrels refused to pay it, so I had Mr. Dammit dug up at once, and sold him for dog's meat. Tilde 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 end of text tilde 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 equals 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 thou art the man. I will now play the Oedipus to the Rattleboro Enigma. I will expound to you as I alone can the secret of the enginery that effected the Rattleboro miracle, the one, the true, the admitted, the undisputed, the indisputable miracle, which put a definite end to infidelity among the Rattleburgers, and converted to the orthodoxy of the grandames all the carnal-minded who had ventured to be skeptical before. This event, which I should be sorry to discuss in a tone of unsuitable levity, occurred in the summer of 18. Mr. Barnabas Shuttleworthy, one of the wealthiest and most respectable citizens of the borough, had been missing for several days under circumstances which gave rise to suspicion of foul play. Mr. Shuttleworthy had set out from Rattleboro very early one Saturday morning, on horseback, with the avowed intention of proceeding to the city of about 15 miles distant, and of returning the night of the same day. 2 hours after his departure, however, his horse returned without him, and without the saddle bags which had been strapped on his back at starting. The animal was wounded too, and covered with mud. These circumstances naturally gave rise to much alarm among the friends of the missing man, and when it was found, on Sunday morning, that he had not yet made his appearance, the whole borough arose en masse to go and look for his body. The foremost and most energetic in instituting this search was the bosom friend of Mr. Shuttleworthy, a Mr. Charles Goodfellow, or, as he was universally called, Charlie Goodfellow, or L.D. Charlie Goodfellow. Now, whether it is a marvelous coincidence, or whether it is that the name itself has an imperceptible effect upon the character, I have never yet been able to ascertain. But the fact is unquestionable, that there never yet was any person named Charles who was not an open, manly, honest, good-natured, and frank-hearted fellow, with a rich, clear voice, that did you good to hear it, and an eye, that looked you always straight in the face, as much as to say, I have a clear conscience myself, am afraid of no man, and am altogether above doing a mean action. And thus all the hearty, careless, walking gentlemen of the stage are very certain to be called Charles. Now, old Charlie Goodfellow, although he had been in Rattleboro not longer than 6 months or thereabouts, and although nobody knew anything about him before he came to settle in the neighborhood, had experienced no difficulty in the world in making the acquaintance of all the respectable people in the borough. Not a man of them, but would have taken his bare word for 1,000 at any moment, and as for the women, there is no saying what they would not have done to oblige him. And all this came of his having been christened Charles, and of his possessing, in consequence, that ingenuous face which is proverbially the veriest letter of recommendation. I have already said that Mr. Shuttleworthy was one of the most respectable, and, undoubtedly, he was the most wealthy man in Rattleboro, while L.D. Charlie Goodfellow was upon as intimate terms with him as if he had been his own brother. The two old gentlemen were next-door neighbors, and, although Mr. Shuttleworthy seldom, if ever, visited L.D. Charlie, and never was known to take a meal in his house, still this did not prevent the two friends from being exceedingly intimate, as I have just observed. For L.D. Charlie never let a day pass without stepping in 3 or 4 times, to see how his neighbor came on, and very often he would stay to breakfast or tea, and almost always to dinner, and then the amount of wine that was made way with by the two cronies at a sitting, it would really be a difficult thing to ascertain. Oh, old Charlie's favorite beverage was Chateau Margaux, and it appeared to do Mr. Shuttleworthy's heart good to see the old fellow swallow it, as he did, quart after quart. So that, one day, when the wine was in, and the wit as a natural consequence, somewhat out, he said to his crony, as he slapped him upon the back, Tell you what it is, old Charlie, apostrophe you are, by all odds, the hardiest old fellow I ever came across in all my born days. And, since you love to guzzle the wine at that fashion, I'll be darned if I don't have to make thee a present of a big box of the Chateau Margaux. Ah, drat me, Mr. Shuttleworthy had a sad habit of swearing, although he seldom went beyond ah, drat me, or why gosh, or why the jolly golly. Drat me, says he, if I don't send an order to town this very afternoon for a double box of the best that can be got, and I'll make ye a present of it, I will. Ye needn't say a word now, I will, I tell ye, and there's an end of it. So look out for it, it will come to hand some of these fine days, precisely when ye are looking for it the least. I mention this little bit of liberality on the part of Mr. Shuttleworthy, just by way of showing you how very intimate an understanding existed between the two friends. Well, on the Sunday morning in question, when it came to be fairly understood that Mr. Shuttleworthy had met with foul play, I never saw anyone so profoundly affected as L.D. Charlie Goodfellow. When he first heard that the horse had come home without his master, and without his master's saddlebags, and all bloody from a pistol shot that had gone. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.